The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
Why was the year 1864 significant for Montana?
It was the year that transformed Montana. It's the year that created Montana. So what you have then is suddenly this new place, never before named, never before created, called Montana, and it's invented in 1864. And so everything changes because suddenly you have this territory imposed on a place dominated by Native nations for hundreds of years. And once you have that in place, once that territory is created, all bets are off.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the west side of the United States. I'm Cherie Newman. My guest this time is Ken Egan, Jr., and we're talking about his book, Montana 1864, Indians, Immigrants, and Gold in the Territorial Year. In your introduction to this book, you describe a train trip you took when you were a little boy. Tell us about that. How old were you? What did you see? What happened?
Wonderful. 7 years old, and we're taking a train, a commuter train, from Streamwood, Illinois, into Chicago. It's only about a 50-minute train ride, and we're going into Chicago to see the Montana Centennial Train. It's April of 1964. And so it's my grandmother and myself and my five siblings. And what we're looking at is this extraordinary marketing device called the Montana Centennial Train. And I became obsessed with one image in particular on that train. And it's a famous painting by J.K. Ralston, After the Battle, which portrays what happened after the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And you can imagine a seven-year-old boy raised on wild, melodramatic TV, and I'm just pulled into that image, particularly an image of a brave scalping a white American soldier. And so in my mind, that became the imprint, that became the memory, that became the source. And so as I was looking ahead to our sesquicentennial, the 150th year, I was asking myself, what kind of train would we design today?
Well, let's talk about what was going on in the country in the mid-1800s. There were lots of men, immigrant men, American-born men, and Native men who were really struggling to find their place in society. Can you just describe a little bit about what was going on?
Yeah, it was a time of incredible turbulence, and it was turbulence that was continent-wide. You put it really well. So it's happening within the United States as such. It's happening within neighboring countries. It's happening within tribal nations here in this place that soon became Montana. And one of the big sources of conflict, of course, was slavery. And slavery is like the inevitable, unavoidable issue in the United States at that time. So you have a lot of men in motion, for example, going to Nebraska and Kansas, trying to determine the fate of those territories. You have men who are following gold rushes to places like California and Colorado and then Idaho. And you have within the Native nations themselves change happening, in part because of these pressures from these various Americans who were infiltrating, moving into this region. The region had been relatively protected, and now suddenly you have this influx of people moving into the Idaho mines, crossing through, placing tremendous pressure. And so suddenly there's a desire for new goods. And how do you get new goods? Well, you do that through trade in skins, skins such as bison. And that leads to all kinds of consequences for, you know, the bison population.
And then there was the war between the states that was alienating people in really awful ways. And a lot of people were trying to get away from that, coming west, looking for a place where they could, what, set up a new nation?
That, very true. Exactly so. So the Civil War is raging in the 1860s. And so you have individuals, men, who are fleeing the fight. And that's one of the big themes in my book, actually, is the enormous number of people who saw the elephant, as it was called. That is, they saw war and they said, I don't want any part of that. So they emigrate to places like what is soon Montana, and they do that in order to escape, of course. They're looking for opportunity, they're looking for wealth, but I really like your point. They are looking to create their own separate nation, if you will, to create the nation that maybe is not possible back east. And so very strong influences out of Missouri and out of the South coming in here, and probably fair to say an even division between Union and Confederate sympathizers in this place.
Between the introduction and chapter one, you've included several quotes. For example, this one from a man named Boone Helm, quote, "Every man for his principles. Hurrah for Jeff Davis. Let her rip." What's that about?
So this is one of the famous road agents who's being hanged by the vigilantes. And Boone Helm had strong Southern sympathies. And so at the moment of death, he's facing his end, his extermination. And what does he do? He chooses to yell out, "Hurrah for Jeff Davis." In other words, hurrah for the Confederacy. Hurrah for that dream of that Southern nation we were just talking about. And I wanted to include that because it's one of the several opening visions that give us a sense of some of the dominant values, beliefs that are driving the characters, the passions that are driving these historical figures. So Boone, in a very succinct form, right at the moment of his death, speaks his belief in the Southern nation.
And he was one of the men hanged by the vigilantes, right?
He was, exactly so. And that remains controversial to this day, and I don't go into it in depth in this book. I think it's been treated well elsewhere. But one of the questions is, were the vigilantes predominantly pro-Union? Were the victims of their hanging spree, as it's called, were they predominantly Confederate-leaning? So was there a strong political dimension to the whole vigilante movement? I tend to discount that, but there are folks who get pretty passionate about that idea.
You included a quote from Joseph Kinsey Howard on page 212, and I'd like you to read that.
Sure. I'm glad to. So Joseph Kinsey Howard, of course, I'm sure many know, is one of the preeminent historians of Montana. His great book, Montana, High, Wide, and Handsome, came out in the early 1940s. And here's what Joe said. "Montana had become a territory in its own right in May 1864, but it nevertheless chose still to regard itself as back of beyond, as a remote, independent, and untouchable empire. It resented and continually obstructed, ungratefully, the federal controls which accompanied the blessings of territorial recognition, and an active and noisy section of its citizenry held that it should continue to be the last refuge of the Confederacy's unreconstructed belligerents. Montana has a legend to the effect that the left wing of the army of Confederate General Price in Missouri never surrendered. It retreated to Montana."
So what was going on in Missouri that made this retreat happen?
Yeah, in many ways, Missouri was the ugliest, believe it or not, of Civil War battlegrounds or contested spaces. And that's because you're right at the center of the country. You have these forces pouring in, Union and Confederate sympathizers. You have longstanding hostilities there. They're on the border of Kansas, and Kansas is kind of a hotbed of what they call Jayhawk radicalism, meaning anti-slavery thinking. So Missouri is the scene of intense guerrilla warfare. And many of the people flowing into Montana out of Missouri literally hop on steamboats and come up river, and they land here, and they're full of this anger. They're full of this rage. They're full of this desire to, outlast, defeat the Union.
I was thinking as I read this book that here is this wide open land. And yes, there were Native people here, but there was no law because Montana wasn't a territory until 1864.
Correct.
There was no law. And so men just, most of them were men, behaved very badly.
They did.
And so I think the Old West is a really good example of what happens if you don't have rules.
Yeah. Absolutely true. The phrase that recurs in my book is wide open towns, wide open town. And people recognize that. That's a famous title for a book about Butte. But I think wide open is the perfect description of these early towns emerging. So we're talking about Bannock City. We're talking about Benton City, Fort Benton. We're talking about Virginia City. And you're absolutely right. You have men who are cut loose from their moorings. They're cut loose from the respectability of church and family. And they're desperately seeking wealth, and that leads to all kinds of bad behavior. And of course, arguably, the road agent gang led by Henry Plummer, and we just talked about one of his, you know, one of his allies who was hanged, Boone Helm. But anyway, so men behaving badly. And one of the stories I try to tell in Montana 1864 is the transition, or the attempted transition, from that wide open lawless craziness to an attempt to impose order at the end of the year. And so I feature a character named Hezekiah Hosmer, who was the first Chief Justice of Montana. And he tries to tell the vigilantes, enough is enough. Law and order has arrived. The new territory is here. A government's in place. But I think you nailed it. I don't think that there was law and order here just because Hosmer shows up and Sidney Edgerton is the governor. That doesn't mean order's here. It's still wide open.
Well, I like the way you laid out this book. You put it into 12 sections that each represent 1 month during the year of 1864. And it shows how fast things changed. But you begin each chapter of the book with an acknowledgement of the Native people.
Yes.
With a description of the moon of that month.
Yes.
Where did you get that information?
So that is actually a Blackfeet account of the moons or the months of the year. And just to talk a little bit about why I did that, one of the goals in writing this book was to show kind of alternative rhythms of living, patterns of living, pace of life. And what I try to suggest through those, I'll call them epigraphs or leads to the chapters, what I'm trying to suggest there is that you have people settled in place here, in this case, the Blackfeet, and they know this place intimately. Each month, each moon is so particular and specific. They know it. They've lived here. They've inhabited this place. And then you have moving through this space, these primarily white men who are moving fast, and they're hungry, and they're in a hurry. And so you have that kind of hectic pace set against what I hope is this sense of being in place, this sense of dwelling and belonging in this place we soon call Montana. So this is the world the Blackfeet epigraphs can show us. This is the world that is being disrupted. This is the world that's being invaded.
The Eagles left in November and came back in February.
Yes.
Lots of little bits of information in those epigraphs.
And I can tell you, I learned a lot from them. And one of the great discoveries for me in writing the book is that I often would say as a teacher, oral storytelling is a powerful form of sharing information and history. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure I truly believed it until I had to slow down myself and really pay attention to oral storytelling from, in this case, the Blackfeet, but also from the Assiniboine, also from the Kootenai. And suddenly you realize there is an awful lot of information there. There is a lot of knowledge there.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. Ken Egan Jr. is here, and we're talking about his book, Montana 1864. If you missed the first part of this program, or any other The Right Question program, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. Links to audio are also on our Facebook page. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about some of the fascinating people who were around Montana 150 years ago and hear about the disaster that was the first legislative session. Don't go away. Thank you. Is there something in particular you were thinking about when you decided to commit to writing this book, something that propelled you into the project?
Great question. Yeah. Truthfully, it was ignorance. So I told that story earlier about, you know, visiting the train, the Centennial train, and then thinking, what would a sesquicentennial train looked like? And then I looked around and I said, there must be a book about Montana 1864. There must be a book that tells us what was happening here in the year this place was invented. And I couldn't find that book. And then what dawned on me is I didn't know much. There were names. You know, I was vaguely aware of John Bozeman. I was vaguely aware of the Stewart brothers. I kind of had this idea about a Mary Ronan because there's this wonderful historian, Ellen Baumler, who keeps talking about her, so she must be interesting. But I didn't know anything about John Owen, for example, who lives up the Bitterroot, and he's been there since 1850, and he's a remarkable man. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know that Granville was married quite young to a Shoshone woman, Aubani, and that they had a long married life, and they produced many children and a very complicated life. And the other element of it was I felt that our histories were not doing justice to the native peoples who were here. And so this book is an attempt to in some way redress that. And if you don't mind me just saying very briefly, I think we're living in a privileged moment in our recognition of native peoples because of both tribal histories. We have new tribal histories and the Indian Education for All Act. I think what we're finding is there's so much more knowledge available, and we just, I think, have to respect that and honor that and recognize that.
And they're great stories.
They are great stories. They are great stories.
Tell us about Mary Ronan.
So Mary Ronan arrives in Montana. It's one of those great fortuitous things that happens for me as a storyteller. She and her family arrive actually initially in Bannock, and then they go to Virginia City virtually as it's discovered and created in 1863. She's 11 years old. She's a kid. But guess what? It's very clear from her memoir, she's an incredibly intelligent, observant, lively child. And she arrived here in the company of one man in particular, obviously her father and her family, but also Jack Gallagher was this fellow who accompanied them on the trail up into Montana. I think it's fair to say as a young girl, she had a crush on Jack, and he was tall and gallant and all of that. So Mary, or Molly Sheen, as she's called, because she's from an Irish immigrant family. So Molly is observing everything happening in Virginia City, and suddenly one day in January of 1864, she's walking home from school, and there is her beloved Jack Gallagher strung up. He's been hanged by the vigilantes. And Molly describes this as a moment that was imprinted in her memory. She never forgot it. She could never forget it. So we are very, very lucky because we have a young girl, very sharp, very bright, very fine writer, great memory, immigrant family, and strong Southern leanings. And so another moment for Molly Sheen in this book is right at the very end in 1865 when she finds out that Lincoln has been assassinated. She actually dances. She dances with her friends at school in Virginia City because the arch enemy, the devil, has died. And subsequently, she feels great regret about that, you know, that dancing. But right in that moment, I think we see the authentic, you know, revelation of these strong Southern sympathies in Molly or Mary.
The influence of her parents, for sure.
Absolutely.
The adults in her life.
Yeah.
Who else did you find out about?
Yeah, one of my favorites is the story of James and Mary Jane Vale. And they're a missionary family that arrive at Sun River Indian Farm. And they actually arrive in 1862. And Sun River Indian Farm was this attempt to convert the Blackfeet, particularly the Piegan, into farmers. And so it's supposed to be a model farm, obviously right on Sun River. It's on the Mullen Road. And so here come these two missionaries, and they're wonderfully idealistic and, I think, fair to say, very, very naive. But in their company, they have two small children and Electa Bryan, who is the sister of Mary Jane. Well, lo and behold, whom should arrive at the Sun River Indian Farm but Henry Plummer, the most notorious of the road agents, the leader of the sheriff in Bannock. And he and Electa fall in love. They end up getting married. And of course, we know how it ends for Henry. Henry is hanged also in January of 1864. It was an extraordinary story because it brought together so many elements, it seemed to me, of what was happening here. So you have the idealistic missionaries, you have the attempt to convert Indians to an agrarian life, you have the realities that the Indians had very little interest in this experiment, you have the road agent threat actually being linked to the Sun River Indian Farm. And in the end, James and Mary Jane just retreat to Iowa. They flee. They're overwhelmed by circumstance.
And things like that are still going on. I know people who have moved to the frontier, as they call it, and they last for a short time and have to flee back east.
Exactly. You're not going to name anybody, I assume. No,
no, I am not. There's a term that you use several times in the book. Let me see if I can remember it correctly. Mining the miners?
Yes, yes, very important idea. And it's often attributed to John Bozeman, who's a character unto himself. That's one of my favorite sections in the book because, again, John Bozeman's a name, but who is he? And so it's often attributed to him. And the idea is that rather than being a miner yourself, you produce goods and services that the miners need, so you extract the wealth from the miners by charging them exorbitant rates. And one of the revelations in the book for me was the high prices of things. My section on Missoula, there's a section in November on Missoula, and in that section, you discover the price of things was just extraordinary. It was kind of, you know, through the roof. So if you're a clever grocer, farmer, trader, you can mine the miners. You can take that gold right away from them. I mean, they're desperate. They're isolated. Where are they going to turn for goods? Where are they going to turn for supplies? They got to go somewhere. And by the way, another character who's featured here is William Andrews Clark, who's, of course, famous as a copper king. But Clark began as a freighter, grocer, supplier into Bannock and Virginia City. And he made a very nice living doing that. And in fact, it was by mining the miners that he set the terms. He started his career as a very wealthy man.
Well, I want to go back to what was happening politically. In May of 1864, Montana became officially a territory designated by the federal government.
Correct.
And officials began to arrive. And toward the end of the year, the first legislative session was put together. So I would like you to read just a couple of paragraphs. I think this is very interesting. You're already laughing, and I'm chuckling inside because we're going to see what happened.
Yes.
This is kind of a precursor to the legislative session.
Gotcha. Great. So on Saturday, October 15th, Republicans gather for a political rally in Virginia City, determined to elect true believers to Montana's first legislature. As summarized in the Montana Post, a large and enthusiastic union ratification meeting was held on Saturday evening last in Virginia City. Judge Bissell presided. We are happy to say it provided a great contrast to the other, that is, the Grand Union Peace Wars North and South Amalgamation Society, humorously called Democrats. Hezekiah Hosmer, the newly appointed Chief Justice of Montana Territory, Wilbur Sanders, and Thomas Dimsdale take their turns declaring their loyalty to the Union cause and their disdain for the opposition party. Sanders' words, as paraphrased in the article, are especially telling. He had been called an extreme man. He would stand by the Union in every extremity, and he believed in one flag and one destiny for the American nation. But on the slavery question, he wished to be understood. Did me think that they degraded themselves by following the footsteps of the missionary and in the enlightened spirit of true religion, endeavoring to elevate the condition and educate the minds of the fallen, the outcast? The rally echoes the invective-laced, hot-blooded, often defamatory political meetings throughout the states as the 1864 presidential election approaches in just 3 weeks. Lincoln's strong-arm defense of the National Union, including suspension of habeas corpus, issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation, and the sheer carnage of the United States' most lethal war, has put his re-election in doubt. His main challenger, none other than the cast-off General George McClellan, carrying the peace cause on his handsome shoulders. The uncertainty of Lincoln's fate, the very man who has signed Montana into creation and appointed Edgerton governor, gives the Virginia City rally an edge and intensity that might otherwise be missing. National Republicans have combined with Democrats supportive of the war to form a National Union Party, a temporary joining of uneasy allies that will sweep the president to a resounding Electoral College victory. Montana's staunch Republican leaders will deploy the same tactic, but with little of the success achieved by the commander-in-chief. The October rally is more given over to destroying enemies than uplifting friends, though attendees very much hope Sanders will be elected the territory's first representative to Congress. There is much talk of disloyalty and failure by opponents to acknowledge the war was forced upon the federal government by secessionists. The result, Sanders goes down to resounding defeat, and Montana's first legislature is evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, assuring a messy session of creating the territory's founding laws in December.
A messy session.
Oh, indeed, a messy session. It was a messy session. You have to picture this. So Governor Edgerton, Sidney Edgerton, is appointed by President Lincoln to be the first governor. He is a radical Republican. He believes wholly in the Republican Party and its cause. And I just have to add here that when we think Republican and Democrat, we kind of have to flip or reverse our understanding of contemporary Republican and Democratic politics. So Republicans would be thought of as more liberal, in other words. So here's Sidney Edgerton, a true believer in the United States, in the Union. He wants to defeat the South. He wants to be sure Montana is a good Union Republican territory. He confronts a legislature that's evenly divided between Confederate-leaning, Southern-sympathizing people and those Union sympathizers. He provides or he delivers this fiery address saying, you all have to believe in the American nation, and if you don't, you shouldn't serve. So the legislature turns into a very difficult, painful one. In fact, it was so bad, they did not even come up with a date for their next meeting. So apparently when they left, they were just so relieved it was over, they just forgot to actually name a date for the next meeting of the legislature, which leads to all kinds of messiness later. And it does make you wonder, whether Joseph Kinsey Howard was right, whether in fact what he claims about Montana seeing itself as back of beyond, as being this kind of separate place, whether in fact there's a lot of truth to that. And so the legislature resolves some key questions. I mean, for example, they decide that if you want to vote, you have to be a white male. And that's a critical decision, obviously, in context of the Civil War and all that.
And 21 years old.
Mm-hmm. So it did establish that franchise and, of course, disenfranchised African Americans, women, et cetera. So it resolves some of those key questions, set up some basic units of governance, the counties, nine counties, et cetera, but basically left a lot unresolved. And really, there's no mechanism for moving forward. And it sets the groundwork for a very famous man whom I couldn't write about because he wasn't here in 1864, sets the groundwork for Thomas Marr, who many know. And Marr shows up. And if anything, the chaos intensifies once Thomas Marr is on the ground.
So is that your next book?
Actually, it might be. Actually, it'd be a great book. Yeah.
Well, I really like your enthusiasm for Montana history.
Thank you.
It's great.
I do love it.
Maybe it'll be infectious.
Yes, I hope so.
Ken Egan Jr. lives in Missoula, Montana, where he is the executive director of Humanities Montana. He's donated his author royalties for Montana 1864 to the programs and grants of Humanities Montana. Look for information about Ken and the book at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq or on our Facebook page. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.